Geekscape.com.
Can the white race survive? Part 3. Egypt. The ancient Greeks originated the story that the Egyptian civilization was the work of Negroes. The repetition of that mistake is still heard. It is especially popular with Negrophilists and with Negro leaders who like to delude themselves and others into the belief that the black peoples have had a share, and in the case of Egypt, a most brilliant share, in creating civilization. The Greeks first began to come into contact with the inhabitants of the Delta and Lower Nile Valley many hundreds of years before Christ. No doubt, when the vigorous prehistoric Hellenes first debauched upon the most southerly fingers of European land and struck out upon the waters of the Mediterranean, they made up a goodly portion of the strange sea peoples who in middle and late dynastic times were mentioned by Egyptian records. In those early times, the Greeks, being a highly imaginative and poetic stock, listened with rapt interest to all the legendary stories in this newfound land of surpassing wonders. Among those legends were those of mixed historical truth that the builders of Egypt came up during the dim past from the south. In the faraway south was the land of Nubia, and the fantastic realms of gold and ivory extending beyond it almost unlimited extent. As the strange black-skinned natives of Nubia and of the still more unknown region of far-distant Yam were so different to the fair-skinned wanderers from the north themselves, it was easy for them to couple the legends of the Egyptians with the belief that the Nilotic civilization had its origin with a black people. Such a belief was planted in their records and held a place in the consideration of serious scholars until very recent times. It remained for the indefatigable archaeologists of the late 19th century to begin the unearthing of proof to the contrary. And not only have these persistent delvers for records of the misty past age brought forth proof that the marvellous civilization of ancient Egypt was the work of a white race, but they have gone further and pictured for us the spectacle of that brilliant page of man's achievement being destroyed by the slow but deadly infiltration of Negroid mixture into the body of the populace. Since 1894, so much proof has been brought to light showing that the ancient Egyptians were whites that one need only devote a little time to be convinced. G. Elliot Smith, one of the greatest anatomists that has devoted time to the subject, and he spent years at it, asserts positively in his book, The Ancient Egyptians and Their Influence Upon the Civilization of Europe, that among the thousands of remains dug up from the cemeteries of pre-dynastic Egypt, he found almost no traces of the Negroid. And this, from the people of Upper Egypt, nearest Nubia, and the rest of the land of Negroes, where naturally contacts with the blacks would occur. He found the well-preserved hair of the ancients to be of a texture and colour similar to that of South Europeans of the present day. Mr. Smith says, "Not a few writers, like the traveller Volney, of the 18th century, have expressed the belief that the ancient Egyptians were Negroes, or at any rate, strongly Negroid. In recent times, even a writer so discriminating as Ripley usually is, has given his adhesion to this view, which I consider to be the most serious blot on his most valuable and interesting memoir, The People of Europe." Smith continues, "The hair of the Proto-Egyptian was precisely similar to that of the brunette South European or Iberian people of the present day, It was a very dark brown or black colour, wavy or almost straight, and sometimes curly, but it presented no resemblance whatsoever to the so-called woolly appearance and peppercorn-like arrangement of the Negro's hair. Studying the medley of opinions put forth during the past 100 years as to the origin of the Egyptians, I have come to an opinion which I will state here as a sort of premise for the rest of this podcast. The most ancient people of whom we find record, whom Smith designates as Proto-Egyptians, those who lived along the Nile of Upper Egypt below the first cataract for some hundreds of years before the first dynasty, were the descendants of immigrants from Asia who first came by way of Arabia and the narrow stretch of water separating the Arabian Peninsula from Africa between the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea. Gradually, these searchers for new lands spread out over Africa. Quite likely, many of them were swallowed up into mixture with the hordes of pure Negroes of the vast hinterland, giving us the beginnings of the brown branches of the African Negroes, while a remnant coursed down the Atbarah, probably through the land of Cush, and found the pleasant Nile Valley below the cataracts. During this long period of close contact with Negro land, it is a likelihood that a small tinge of Negro blood was picked up and spread through the population. I wish to offer here an interesting point for study. It is a well-known fact that the first Europeans to visit South and Southeast Africa during the 15th century found the Bantus and other natives to have much indication of the white man in their ancestry. More modern students have found a definite trail of white mixture among the millions of Bantus and neighbouring Negroes. W.C. Willoughby inadequately describes very ancient ruins which exist in Mashonaland and Matabeland and adjacent districts of South Africa. These ruins are the relics of a race of builders so ancient that the Bantus have no legendary records of them. The Negroes never even made a pretense of trying to copy the architecture left in their midst, but the lighter colour and other definite traces of a white strain in the natives of the southern and southeastern portions of Africa tells a great deal. It is reasonable to believe that the greater bulk of the immigrants who crossed from Aden into Africa followed the more immediately habitable coastlands down towards the southern end of the continent, developing their own culture, and after centuries were engulfed in the ocean of Negro blood which surrounded them. The little rivulet of immigrants which streamed off into the exclusive Nile Valley, finding no indigenous Negroes with whom to mix, and, as pointed out hereafter, receiving new white blood from the north, remained relatively pure whites. There is much historical evidence that the great people, who from the first dynasty onwards built the real brilliance of ancient Egypt, received fresh stocks of white blood from Asia by way of the Isthmus or Suez, for Khufu and his successors would not have chosen the place for the greatest of all the pyramids so close to Asia in the lower valley had that location not have become a main centre of the kingdom. We know that in the very earliest times, the Asiatics had reached Egypt by way of the Isthmus. It would be unreasonable not to believe that already, in the time of the Old Kingdom and the rise of the first civilization, the Delta and adjacent Lower Valley were not inhabited by immigration from nearby Asia. James Henry Breasted adheres to the opinion that the Egyptian civilization began in the Delta region, although there is much to indicate that a less vigorous form developed earlier, or at least contemporaneously, in the Upper Valley. Here in the Lower Valley, these progressive people had begun to rise towards a high culture and social organization when Menes, pharaoh of Upper Egypt, decided to consolidate the entire valley into one kingdom. Thenceforwards, the entire Nile Valley, from the delta to the first cataract, was welded into a single people, ruled over, with little interruption, by the pharaohs for nearly 3,000 years. And when we study the histories of Egypt, especially the latest editions of that erudite Egyptologist, James Henry Breasted, we find ample evidence that there was almost a constant stream of new blood coming in from Asia by way of the Isthmus and from Libya, a land then populated by whites. This new blood came either by immigration or through conquering expeditions of the pharaohs, who invaded contiguous Asiatic lands and returned with captives whom they enslaved and later assimilated. Thus, though from the first the bloodstream of the southern people may have been tainted with a small admixture of Negroid blood, the main body of Egypt was kept nearly pure for thousands of years by the never-ceasing influx of whites from the Semitic and other white peoples in the north. The fact that the people, even those of the south in pre-dynastic times, were whites, is further attested by Smith throughout his book. I wish to first establish the fact that the ancient Egyptians, those responsible for perhaps the greatest of the earlier examples of civilization, were whites. Then I will show that in spite of numerous setbacks through their long history, they always came back to hurdle all obstacles and build again, often more brilliantly than before, up until near the 25th dynasty, when the final irretrievable submergence occurred. It was not until then that the blood of the Negro had seeped so thoroughly into the body of the people that for the first time a Negroid pharaoh, Taharqa, occupied the throne. G. Elliot Smith has perhaps never given conscious thought to the idea advanced here that the Negro and Negroid mixtures are not inherently capable of even sustaining civilized culture when given them by the whites, yet in his book he refers to a feature that supports such assertion and at the same time adds proof that the real Egyptians were whites. He writes, "The recently acquired knowledge of the early ethnography of Nubia, which has been rescued in the course of the archaeological survey of that country, has familiarized us with an epoch that lasted until about 2800 BC, when Egypt and Lower Nubia were occupied by one uniform population in the same stage of culture. But from the time of the Third Dynasty onwards, a great contrast becomes apparent in the development of the two countries, respectively, north and south of the First Cataract." When this information first came to light, in 1908, it was interpreted as meaning that while Egypt advanced with rapid strides towards the attainment of her greatest artistic and cultural triumphs, Nubia not only failed to keep pace with her, but actually fell away from the standard of knowledge and skill she had possessed before the times of the pyramid builders. This was further explained by the hypothesis that in the competition for the acquirement of the fat lands of Egypt, only the weaker brethren were left in Nubia, and these feeble folk were unable to resist the immigration of Negroes who came up from the south, intermingled with them, and dragged down their cultural attainments to a lower place. A more detailed study of the human remains obtained from graves made in Lower Nubia at the time of the ancient empire in Egypt has convinced me that a slightly different explanation must be found to account for the known facts. In the first place, practically no pure Negroes were found among the remains of these people buried in Nubia during the ancient empire, although the population as a whole bears ample evidence of Negro admixture. Presumably, this means that the process of mixing did not take place in Nubia, but further south, and that it was the mongrel population and not the Negro element only that came north into Nubia. The difference in culture was not the result of a falling away from a higher standard, but was due in all probability to the fact that the less favourably placed kinsmen of the proto-Egyptians had not kept pace with them in their acquirement of a higher civilization. Less than a millennium later, another wave of kinsmen of the proto-Egyptians moved north into Nubia. They were more strongly Negroid than their predecessors, and brought with them a culture more definitely specialized and differentiated from that of Egypt, and more obviously tainted with African influence. There could have been but one reason for this weakening of the buffer land between Egypt proper and the land of the Negroes, whether Mr. Smith realized it or not, and that was the swelling tide of Negroid blood. It is not necessary, for the purpose of this podcast, to cite exhaustively all references bearing out this new assertion in ethnology, but for the benefit of those students who wish to look up authorities cited here, I refer them to the whole of Smith's book. My declaration that the beginning of greatest brilliance of Egyptian civilization dated from a time after infusion of a purer Asiatic white strain, antedating the first pyramid builders, is strikingly supported by Smith on page 111. Here, after showing that the cranium measurements of the Giza epoch showed well above 1500 cubic centimetres, he adds that the more ancient proto-Egyptians measured less than 1400 cubic centimetres, so that there was more than 100 cc difference in the average dimensions of the brain in the autochthonous population. Mr. Smith believes the proto-Egyptians were autochthonous to the Nile Valley. Of Egypt before and after, the alien strain was infused into it. A little further on, he adds, how much this increase in the mere bulk of the brain had to do with the precocious ripening of Egyptian civilization in Lower Egypt, it is impossible to say. It was not sufficiently potent to deflect the stream of Nilotic culture into new channels, but it cannot be denied that the deepening and broadening of the Egyptian's conceptions and the marked aggrandizement of his achievements at this time must have been due in some measure to the stimulation of this big-brained foreign element which had been added to his constitution. It is my conviction that the proto-Egyptians coming into the Nile Valley by the southern route picked up some Negro blood, as suggested heretofore, and that it was not until the nation was nearly purified by newer immigration from the north that the real greatness of Egypt began. Students studying the records with this in mind will find much to support such a view. Such a mighty authority as James Henry Breasted himself, who as Egyptologist and as historian of the ancient world has no superior, goes so far as to state that the Delta civilization was probably earlier than that of Upper Egypt, but that the yearly flood of mud long ago obliterated the traces of it. On the other hand, the extremely dry climate of the desert burial grounds of Upper Egypt and about the sites of the cities there preserved to a wonderful degree much of the most ancient inhabitants. Breasted says, unfortunately, the delta is so deeply overlaid with deposits of Nile mud that the material remains of its earliest civilization are buried forever from our reach. That civilization was probably earlier and more advanced than that of the valley above. Already, in the 43rd century BC, the men of the Delta had discovered the year of 365 days, and they introduced a calendar year of this length, beginning on the day when Sirius rose at sunrise, as determined in the latitude of the southern Delta, where these earliest astronomers lived, in 4241 BC. It is the civilization of the Delta therefore, which furnishes us with the earliest fixed date in the history of the world. Let us look at some testimony from this other great authority on ancient Egypt, in corroboration of G. Eliot Smith's assertions that the civilization builders of that land were whites. I do not know which one, Smith or Breasted, first published his discovery of the fact. Smith began his studies of ancient Egypt in 1902, while the earliest work of Breasted, in which I have seen references distinguishing between the Negroes of Nubia and the whites of Egypt, is his book quoted earlier and published in 1908. As their specialized methods of study are different, and each in his field stands in the highest ranks of scholarly attainments, I believe it is sufficient to quote them here, although Maspero and others give evidence of some value to the same end. Before going on to quote Breasted, prompted by the content of his findings, let us draw a comparison with our own times from the practice in Egypt of giving military training to Negroes. We have heard much during the past two or three decades, and we hear it even in louder tones today, about the danger to the supremacy of the white race in our modern world that lies in giving the coloured races training in and full access to the military science developed only by the white race. It is contended that the white man, by his superior intellect and greater inventive genius, can ever remain the master so long as he withholds his military developments from the vastly more numerous coloured sections of humanity. But that if the coloured peoples are educated by the whites and taught the uses of his weapons, being so overwhelmingly superior in numbers, they will eventually, and at a quite early date, overrun Europe and America. George Winter Mitchell, writing in the June to July-August 1927 number of the North American Review, paints a vivid picture of the possible future as he sees it. He apparently fails to realize the ultimate danger to civilization that would result should his imaginative picture ever eventuate into reality. He says, writing under the title of Perils of Race Color, "The yellow race, at first under the hegemony of Japan, and later under the leadership of the Chinese, will overrun Europe. These nations are fast learning all the military and industrial methods of the West, and in time will beat the whites at their own game. Even if the future should see a universal disarmament, it can only be a question of time until the Mongoloids have established themselves all over Europe by means of peaceful penetration. Already, the yellow race almost equals in number all the branches of the white races combined, and at the rate of which they will breed until favourable conditions they will, in a century or two, outnumber the whites by many millions. In time, then, Europe will be overrun. Europeans who have not been exterminated will, for the most part, flee to America. Those who remain will be bred out, for the older race is always prepotent and dominant when it comes to a matter of breeding. The last stand of the whites will be made in the Americas, but it will be only a last stand, for the yellow races will then have them in the jaws of a vice." I quote the previous as a representative sample of many such warnings in contemporary newspapers, magazines, and books. Now let us look at a related situation in ancient Egypt. In Breasted's more recent work, we find the records written by old Uni, the trusted right-hand man of Pepi I, in which he mentions coming into contact during military operations for his king with the Urtet Negroes, the Mazoi Negroes, the Yam Negroes, among the Wawat Negroes, among the Kau Negroes, etc. And studying the records of Uni As given us by Breasted, we learn that he was commissioned by Pepi I to induct Negroes into the Egyptian military forces and train them to fight the Bedouins of the north and the other enemies of the kingdom. The Egyptians themselves were strongly averse to military service, which led to extensive use of Negro mercenaries in the army of the pharaohs. When we read of the early struggles of the Egyptians against the Negro tribes and see how easily the blacks were vanquished, and then see in later times how much more boldly and successfully the Nubians and their southern allies battled the Egyptians, we can easily understand that the Negroes put to good use their acquired knowledge of military equipment and strategy as taught them by the whites. But it is evident that from the time of Pepi I throughout the long history of ancient Egypt, much use was made of Negro contingents in the armies of Egypt. This was so generally the case that the name of the Mazoi Negroes came to be adopted into the language of Egypt to mean soldier, and exists in the latest form of Coptic speech as Matoi. The Negro mercenaries in the armies of Egypt were not such a menace to the purity of the whites as families of slaves later proved to be. The soldier was recruited in his native region and sent to far parts of the River Kingdom. Thus, when he died or was killed in action, he left no offspring in the population. His women folks remained at home. As in modern times, so it must have been in the ancient world of Egypt, that the white woman, except for rare individuals of a very low type, was far more loath to mate with the black man than her brother was with the negress. Therefore, the actual mixture of the races started only when the Egyptian landowners and other chief men found profit in exploiting Negro slave labor. We learn that such a practice of enslaving Negro captives did take place in the earliest times. As a result of this slavery, the Negro women were brought in and soon began to bear children by the white masters. By the time of the reign of Sesostris III in the 12th dynasty, we find an indication that the pharaoh had learned to fear infiltration of the Negroes into the population and took measures to prevent it. Breasted translates the first Semneh. He says, Sesostris III, having in his 8th year pushed his southern advance above the second cataract to a point about 37 miles south of Wadi Halfa, set up his landmark, the stone, marking the southern boundary of his realm. His great-grandfather, Sesostris I, had already conquered to this point, but Sesostris III was now prepared to maintain the conquest. Then comes the translation of the stela. Southern boundary, made in the year 8, under the majesty of the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Sesostris III, who is given life for ever and ever, in order to prevent that any Negro should cross it by water or by land with a ship or any herds of the Negroes, except a Negro who shall come to do trading in Iken or with a commission. Every good thing shall be done with them, but without allowing a ship of the Negroes to pass by Heh, going downstream, for ever. We find the practice of taking slaves, both in the north and from the Negroes of the south, to have become a regular practice by the time of the first period of the empire, under the great Thutmose III. Breasted tells us that Nubia was rendering her regular impost of Negro slaves to the pharaoh. But on the same page, we read how the conquering forces of the same pharaoh, returning from the frequent campaigns in Palestine and further Asia, brought great numbers of white slaves, although black slaves were also brought back after campaigns against the Hittites in the region now known as Syria. Anderson says that Thutmose III received as tribute from the great king of the Hittites, gold and black slaves. But there is ample evidence that the number of Semitic, Mitanni, and other slaves of the whites in the north brought into Egypt greatly outnumbered the black slaves, thus favorably counterbalancing, for many centuries, the Negroid element that gradually found its way into the population. We cannot stress too much the importance of the practice of enslaving white captives as well as Negroes during the entire long period of Egyptian brilliance. Such practice explains the long life of that ancient civilization. The landed gentry, the nobleman class, needed slaves, and white slaves were preferable, when available, to the blacks. If such had not been the case, and if Negro slaves had been the only source of enforced labour needed by the large landowning nobles and by the leisure class of the royal cities, history would tell us a vastly different and shorter story of Egyptian eminence in the ancient world. As it was, receiving continually new white blood from Asia, and in later times from the northern shores and the islands of the Mediterranean, where at that time a fair-haired, blue-eyed race had raised flourishing civilizations, the white blood remained in the ascendancy, quite likely in complete purity, in most of the population of Egypt for nearly 3,000 years. From the time of the 12th dynasty on down to the 25th, the seepage of Negroid blood through the Egyptian population progressed far more slowly than such a mixture is going on in our modern world in those parts of the earth closely in contact with the coloured elements. In the finely moulded features of Ramses II, preserved in the black granite figure held at Turin, we find no trace of the Negroid that must have by that time been widely distributed among the lower classes. But on the same Britannica plate, we see a picture of four types of the population that undoubtedly existed in the time of Seti I, father of Ramses II. One shows the white Egyptian type, while two of the others are clearly and heavily Negroid, the other supposed to have been Syrian. The Britannica classes them as Western, Syrian, and two Negroes. From the earlier tombs and other sources of illustrations, we find no such remarkable recognition of the spread of the Negro as a part of the whole population outside of far Upper Egypt. This is a noteworthy proof of the increase in the population of the Negroid element. This period of Seti I and his illustrious son, Ramses II, was approximately 1300 BC. Glimpses given by history, as now being reconstructed from archaeological remains, reveal here and there, during the centuries immediately following the Second Empire period, a wider and higher spread of the Negroid element and its influence, especially in Upper Egypt, the section more contiguous to Nubia. In the latter country, at the time of the Second Empire, the population below the ruling aristocracy was more than likely nothing but a mongrel mixture, even if it had not been so for hundreds of years previously.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.